Hello, and welcome to another wonderful episode of Saved by the 90s. My name's Adam Patterson. With me today, we got Ken Bakley. Hey, Ken.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing well. My life is utter chaos right now, but I'm getting through it.
It's like I'm doing well, but it's with a caveat.
Sure. Yeah, of course. There's an asterisk there.
Yeah.
This month on the show, we're going to be taking a look at four comic strip movies. I almost said comic book movies because I'm so used to saying that, but comic strip movies. So this is an unscripted episode. We're trying that out to see how that goes. We did it before, and I think that
we've done it before, and it turns out okay.
I wanted to try it again with this episode. Just because, like, I started to write something, and then I was like, you know, it's just, I'm not really feeling this. The connective tissue is just not really there. So I just wanted to kind of to wing it this month and see how it goes.
I was thinking, looking back on these movies, they have obviously a unifying, they have a trait that they share, but otherwise you might not really think about a lot of them in the same thought. They don't really lend themselves to smooth transitions in between our reviews.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and talk about our first film, Dick Tracy.
From Touchstone Pictures.
Let's go!
Big Boy Caprice. Flat Top. Prune Face. Mumbles. Lips Manless. And the Blank are out to get the greatest detective of all time.
I'm rubbing him out.
I want him dead!
Nobody touches Tracy but me.
Tracy.
Tracy.
Tracy?
You mind if I call you Dick?
When it's time to fight crime, he's your man. Warren Beatty is Dick Tracy, rated PG. Dark Friday at a theater near you.
This is directed by Warren Beatty, and it stars Warren Beatty, among many, many others. I have a synopsis here. The comic strip detective finds his life vastly complicated when Breathless Mahoney makes advances toward him while he is trying to battle Big Boy Caprice's united mob. Now, this came out in June 15th, 1990.
32 years ago from the month where...
That's crazy, and it makes me feel very old. So, I saw this movie in the theater. My dad took me to go see this, and I freaking loved it. I loved this movie so much, and I had, like, action figures, and I remember I also had a Dick Tracy book that had all of the comic strips in it. It was, like, a big, like, coffee table book that was, like, the complete Dick Tracy. So I was, like, all into Dick Tracy when I was very little. So I was really interested to revisit this movie just because I hadn't seen it for many, many years. And this felt like the type of movie that maybe wouldn't necessarily hold up. However, I think I still had a blast with this movie. I still think it was incredibly fun. What were your initial impressions of Dick Tracy?
So I saw this movie for the first time a couple of years ago after hearing it talked about quite a lot. And my general feeling was that I think I really admire this movie on a lot of levels. It doesn't really work for me in terms of just feeling like I'm just like totally in the zone for Dick Tracy. my God, this is just such a... This is just one of the most unforgettable looking movies.
Yeah, it's like...
that there is.
It's like they... The way that they did comic book movies, or just any, like, comic strip movies, what have you, back then, it was vastly different than how they do it now. Like, back then, they wanted to make things look like a comic book. Like, they wanted to try to capture the visual style of the comic book, like, and make it as close to that as possible. So, in the case of Dick Tracy, it's like, it's just so, like the aesthetic is so in your face. Everything, the colors, the set, it is like very, very animated, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I could look at compositions from this movie forever.
There, I mean, it's just, it's incredible. Like the all the production design in this movie, the makeup, like you have this, you know, great rogues gallery of villains like Flat Top and Prune Face and all of these great characters, some of whom only show up for like one scene, and you're just like, wow, like the one that always struck me was Little Face. I always liked Little Face.
Yeah,
but yeah, some of them they only pop up for like one scene, but like so much went into crafting these crazy looking characters, and you know, just I just love the style of this movie.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't. Some of it looks dated for sure. Like some of, but at the same time, it's like, it kind of is designed to look like an older, you know, movie, right? Like a lot of the sets and things felt like they were shot on like a studio backlot, and I think that that was like very intentionally presented, and I just think it looks great. Even to this day, I think it looks really good.
Yeah, I was about to say, if there's any one part of this movie's look that I wanted to single out, it's in particular just any exterior scene set on like a street.
Oh yeah, it's just the amount of color used, like just vibrant color. Every scene is just completely bathed in color, and then you have these like really incredible split diopter shots that are just you know, they pop up periodically throughout the movie, and it's just such a visual feast, this movie. Now, I mean, as far as the plot goes and the characters, you know, it might falter a bit in those those departments a lot, but
yeah, but
it's not the most intellectually stimulating movie, and the narrative itself, I think, is just a bit lacking, and I think a lot of aspects of it are not fully developed, and like the whole Breathless Mahoney thing is, I don't know, it almost feels tacked on at times. Especially with the no face type, that whole thing.
yeah, I mean, that is the thing, is it's just I think the feeling of, especially rewatching it, that kind of felt more, that was more apparent to me on a rewatch, just because I was thinking there's not a lot there to take this movie at just that face value of you're here and following a story. But then again, as contrary to what people try to say, movies are not just there for their narratives. And it's like, oh, well, I can still look at this flawed in that sense, yes, but just completely astonishing looking and feeling technical accomplishment.
Yeah, and you have these like really crazy outlandish characters, and most of the actors that are portraying these characters are just leaning into it, like, you know, super hard. Like, especially yeah. Al Pacino as Big Boy Caprice. I mean, what an iconic role for him. I mean, he hams it up so bad, and he just looks like he's having a blast with this role. And then, you know, you have William Forsythe as Flat Top. He's I would say almost unrecognizable in that role.
Yeah.
Because, like, I knew he was in this movie, but I forgot that he was Flat Top. So the whole time I'm watching, I'm like, who is that? Who is that? And then afterwards, yeah. I was like, oh my God, it's William. That's William Forsythe. Holy crap. It's mm-hmm. so crazy.
Yeah. If there's a degree to which that really does feel like it's like the plotting or structuring of the film is affecting it, it does feel it's like you have these astonishing characters and this cast that is just completely just all in for it, and it feels like there could have been more for them to do.
Yeah, it is kind of unfortunate, like, because to me that's the best part. Like, the best part is mm-hmm. you know, Dick Tracy hunting down and interacting with the bad guys and all of those crazy villains and stuff, and I feel like that's all just kind of underutilized. And then the overall, like, a lot of the bullet points of the plot here are just feel really generic in comparison to the actual characters that are involved.
Yeah.
So I feel like at the end of the day, it's just kind of a wasted opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting degree, and why I kind of tried to separate the two before is that there's nothing about this plot that is terribly engaging or interesting, but also when you're just watching this movie happen, it doesn't matter very much.
No, not really. And no. At the end of the day, the simple plot does sort of fit into the kind of hard-boiled detective story. Yeah. I just think it could have been a lot better.
Yeah, it's good, and it could have been.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been great. Yeah. Now, if I remember correctly, this wasn't very well received when it came out. It did win multiple Oscars. It won 3 Oscars for one for Best Art Direction, Set Direction, Best Makeup, and Best Music Original Song, which was for the Stephen Sondheim song.
Yeah, Sondheim wrote the songs
for this. and Danny Elfman did the score, so
mm-hmm.
I mean, when you watch this, you're just like, whoa, this is firing on all cylinders as far as like the 90s vibe. You have the classic Elfman score in there that feels very like Tim Burton / Tim Burton-esque, and it just, you know, it came out in 90, but man, like, I feel like that this is like a sign of things to come for the decade. You have the great music, you have the, like, just, it's just oozing with style, you have the crazy prosthetics and over the top characters. It's just I think it does a good job of encapsulating a lot of the film trends of the decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would I think it would be natural to look at a movie from 1990, 1991 and say that it still feels indistinguishable from a late 80s movie in many respects, but this one does feel like it's kind of it is pushing forward.
Yeah, I think that it is interesting because anytime we cover a 1990 movie or even some 91 movies, a lot of times they do basically just feel like 80s movies. I mean, there have been some where you like mm-hmm. couldn't tell that it wasn't an 80s movie. But mm-hmm. this one, like you said, it does feel like it's pushing forward into that decade, even though it came out so early.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, if you haven't seen Dick Tracy yet, I definitely do recommend it because I think that it's still a tremendous amount of fun, even though I think that maybe I do have some nostalgic like kind of sentimental vibes from it. I think trying to set that aside, it's still worth a look.
You might, but I think it'd be hard to see this movie at a young age and not just have it, because it's just so unforgettable looking and just so singular in that sense. I think it would be difficult just to not carry this movie and this look and feel this movie with you.
Yeah. Speaking of movies that have a very distinct look and feel, I think we can move on to our next film, The Addams Family.
The other family. Loving parents.
Last night, you were like some desperate howling demon. You frightened me.
Don't do it again.
Playful children.
Where's your costume?
I'm a homicidal maniac. They look just like everyone else.
An uncle.
Look, a new chapter.
Scabs. Visiting relatives.
It, old man!
And a thing.
Thing, you're a handful.
The Addams Family. Rated PG-13. Now playing at theaters everywhere.
So this is directed by Barry Sonnenfeld. I have a synopsis here. Con artists plan to fleece an eccentric family using an accomplice who claims to be their long-lost uncle. Of course, this is based on the comic strip by Charles Addams, which was in the New Yorker. It was a single-panel strip, sort of like Family Circus, or one of those, Far Side. And
it's still a nice feature of the New Yorker today, is that you'll just flip through the magazine and just throughout all of the different stories, there'll just still be unrelated single panel comics throughout it.
Now, we covered Addams Family Values a while back on the show. I think it was the Thanksgiving episode.
Yeah,
and
that it's the one where David Krumholtz was in three of the four movies or something.
So we're circling back now. We both enjoyed the second Addams Family movie tremendously. Mm-hmm. I think that it's probably going to be safe to say that we both enjoyed this one tremendously as well. Correct?
Yes.
Yeah, this movie's great. Like, there's just there's no doubt about it. This movie's incredible. Like. This is another one that I saw in theaters with my family, and I absolutely freaking adored this movie. I still do. I think that it holds up tremendously well. Like, this movie looks great to this day, and it's still funny, and it's still unique. Like, there's just, you know, they did, like, the animated one, was it just a couple years ago that they came out with the animated ones? And they're just...
I don't think I ever saw
they're
that.
Just not the same.
Hmm.
This... The original film... 90s film adaptations are just... They're just so much better. It really... I think it boils down to the cast for the most part. But...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. What were your initial impressions of the Addams Family?
I still feel like maybe because I've seen coming to seeing these movies in their entirety, I'm seeing them in the wrong order because I think I've seen parts of this, but I don't think I've seen it all the way through. And so I'm coming back to watch it in its entirety a couple years after I've seen Addams Family Values. That said, I think I might be a little less enthusiastic about this movie than you are about it, or that I am about Addams Family Values. I still like it very much.
I don't know which one I like more. I guess I like this one more. I guess I like, I'd say they're both, I like them both pretty much the same. I don't know if I choose one over the other. I think that the interesting thing about this one was just, it was just new, being the first one, and You don't really know what to expect going into it, and so when you first, you know, are introduced to this version of the Addams Family and the type of comedy, the style of comedy that this movie series brings, I think that it's just a lot of fun. But I think that I don't know, it felt new to me when this first came out.
Oh yeah. It feels, it's, there's just this wonderful effortlessness to it. Like, in terms of, like, you don't feel it trying to make itself work as a movie. And in that way, you know, just how much craft and effort had to go into making it look so singular and effortless. It just moves at this great pace with this wonderful, breezy enjoyability to
it. And that's the thing, like, with a movie like this, I don't need a heavy plot. Like, to me, just spending time with this family and just watching them go about their day-to-day lives, that's it. That's entertaining enough for me. And so I feel like with Adam's Family Values, they added a lot. There was just a lot more plot happening. Whereas in this one, it was a lot more, a lot simpler as far as like what was happening with the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it works out really, really nicely because you do get to just see the inner workings of the family and the just the wacky, just the zaniness of each of these characters and their weird lives. But I also like that they don't bother trying to explain anything. You know, like
that I really appreciate.
Like why this family is like this, where they come from, because they're living in the modern world. So it's not like, you know, it's not like they're sent here from somewhere else or whatever. They're just living in the 90s, but they are just a very eccentric family.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of movies are attempted to explain themselves in that sense, and they shouldn't feel that need.
Yeah, I think that another good example is the Brady Bunch movie. I don't know if you've seen any of those, but
I know the concept though.
Yeah, I mean it's
of how they adapted.
It's
that,
basically the same thing where it's a family in modern times, but they're just like living in the past, like they're just living back then, and there's like nobody really explains it, but I like that. You have a great cast here too. I mean this movie wouldn't be really anything. I mean, part of it is the aesthetic, sure, and the morbid jokes that are involved and like, you know, the creepiness of it. But that's propelled by this really amazing cast led by Raul Julia as Gomez and Angelica Houston as Morticia. Both are just absolutely incredible in these roles. Like
here.
they're just so good in these roles. And then of course, you have Uncle Fester, played by Christopher Lloyd. If you don't remember, the plot of this one is that, like, he and Gomez have a falling out, and he's gone for, like, 25 years. And there's this woman who is, she's like a con artist, and she's associated with the Adams, is it their lawyer? It's their lawyer, right? And he... They devised this plan because her quote unquote son has a striking resemblance to Fester. So they try to get him to pretend to be the son, although they didn't realize that he actually, or sorry, Fester, they didn't realize that he actually was Fester. So that's the sort of basic plot of it all. And, you know, there's just a, I don't know. It's a pretty light plot, but man, I just have a lot of fun with this.
I'm actually trying to figure out exactly what I was saying earlier about what might have made me like it less than I was letting on. But the more we're talking about, the more that you're talking about this, really, the more I am coming around it even more than I already did. I am warming to it the more I hear you talk about your enjoyment
and also,
of it. And I'm like, what was my problem?
Also, like, there's like a surprising amount of like world building within this movie too. Because not only do we meet the Addams Family, which in and of themselves are sort of fascinating to watch, like, you know, Wednesday and Pugsley and the granny. And, of course, you have Thing, who is just a hand, if you don't remember. But there's this really great scene where it's sort of like this family reunion that they have, and you have all of these other characters from their extended family come in, and they're all, like, weird and in their own right. And this is where you have, like, Cousin It, who's just, you know, hair. He's just hair. Interestingly, that character played by John Franklin, who was in the Children of the Corn movies. He was, I think his name was the Mordecai in the Children of the Corn movies. Isaac. I'm sorry. Isaac.
Yeah, there is, I think, more. Now, that as you mentioned, there is more to this in terms of building out than seems apparent at first sight. And again, I think that just speaks to the relaxed, breezy tone to the movie. I think if you compare that to, like, how a movie that's so... for lack of a better term, a franchise movie today, they're very, very self-serious and about their world building, because they know that that's the those are the points from which everything else must emerge.
Mm-hmm.
So just one where it's like, there, here we go, here's some stuff. Here's a bit more of this. You know what this is. You might not know what this is. Maybe there'll be more. Maybe there won't be.
Yeah, I think that it does a good job of mm-hmm. the world building. I like all of that. And this is this was the directorial debut from Barry Sonnenfeld as well, which I thought was kind of interesting.
It's a very good debut.
It is a good debut. Yeah, I think mm-hmm. that it set him on a pretty good trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
He would do, like, the Men in Black movies and,
mm-hmm.
you know, some other maybe ones that we shouldn't yeah, really talk about. I'm looking about, at his
filmography now. There are good movies in here, and there are not good movies in here.
Yeah.
it's an interesting mix.
It's a varied filmography, for sure. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
it's strange. It's a strange filmography. I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess a lot of these are probably just, like, paydays for him. I mean, I can't see it any other way. It's not like, it's weird, because when you see the Addams Family movies, the Men in Black movies, even Wild Wild West, even though that's not a good movie, There's like a sort of a distinct style there, but then, like, and also, like, a series of unfortunate events too, which was kind of recent. But then you have, like,
they produce that. Yeah.
Then you have, like, some of these other ones, like with, like, the Bridget Show. Like, what's the Bridget Show? TV movie from 2009. He did that Nine Lives movie. I think we talked about this probably.
Yeah, I think the last time we talked about Sonnenfeld, we talked about how it ends with Nine Lives. Yeah.
Nine Lives.
It's also got RV in there, too.
Yep, RV. I mean...
Yeah, weird career.
Definitely a weird career, for sure.
I mean, a very successful one.
Absolutely, yeah, I mean... He's still working regularly. I mean, he did that Schmigadoon show, which was my wife really liked that show. I didn't really get into it, but it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't know. So that's the Addams Family. If you haven't seen that yet, go ahead and check it out. I think it's a great movie. Both that and the sequel are highly recommended.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on, one that I might not recommend here would be Dennis the Menace from 1993.
The family hit of the summer is finally here. Hilarious, irresistible, rip-roaring, family fun. Dennis the Menace.
That's me!
Rated PG. Now play.
This is directed by Nick Castle. And I have a synopsis here. When his parents have to go out of town on business, Dennis stays with Mr. and Mrs. Wilson. He's driving Mr. Wilson crazy, but he is just trying to be helpful, even to the thief who arrived in town. Now,
we were having so much fun today until
now. Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of a lopsided episode, I think.
Oh yeah,
I think. We start off at the peak, and now we're like rapidly declining.
Mm-hmm.
So, man, so I actually liked this movie when I was a kid. I remember I didn't see it in the theater or anything like that, but I did. I was a big fan of the Problem Child movies, which this is sort of like Problem Child mixed with Home Alone, I think. Definitely has some pretty strong Home Alone vibes. John Hughes. Yeah, John Hughes did write it, and I think he produced it too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have that sort of Home Alone DNA in here. Interestingly, Nick Castle, who directed this, is he plays the Shape in the Halloween movies. He's Michael Myers.
It's an interesting fact. He's done a bunch of these.
You want to talk about a varied career.
That's an interesting career. He's directed a handful of movies. He is also the Shape.
Yeah. He directed Major Pain. He did The Last Starfighter, which was, you know, big 80s movie. But then he also has a really good writing career too. He did Escape from New York. He did this. I guess that's really the big one, isn't it? He did August Rush.
Hmm.
But
it seems to be his most recent writing credit.
So he's had a really interesting career. And of course they brought him back to play Michael Myers in the new David Gordon Green directed Halloween movies as well. So yeah, very interesting career.
Hmm.
Now,
this is not a very interesting movie.
No, so Dennis the Menace, I think it should go to show you how we feel about this movie when we spend that much time at the top talking about the director and his interesting career. Because this movie, there's just not a lot to say about it. It feels very, very much like every live-action kids movie in the 90s. It's a movie where you have kids just terrorizing adults and being... being little psychos.
I mean, I laugh because that's literally all the only thing that happens.
He's such a, and the whole thing with this is that, like, Dennis, he is a menace, but he's just trying to be a good person. Like, he's trying to be helpful or whatever. But so much of this movie is not that. Like, he just seems like he's a bad person. Like, he's just a bad little kid.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of it is, I mean, obviously the parents are to blame almost entirely on this, because it seems like they just let him do whatever he wants. Like, they don't have any control over this kid at all. And then
they seem all uninterested in his life.
I think that by the time this movie starts, they realize that they're not going to be able to do anything to control this kid, so they just let it happen. Mm-hmm. So they just, like, let it go. But it opens with Dennis, like, so Walter Matthau plays Mr. Wilson, and he's waking up, and then he gets up in the morning, and then he realizes that Dennis is on his way, so he, like, tries to pretend like he's asleep. But my question is, like, why don't you just lock your door? Like, keep your front door locked, and then that way the kid won't come terrorize you.
Well, isn't there that line when the Christopher Lloyd character sees the town and thinks it's going to be a tremendous place to steal things from because it looks like the kind of suburb where people don't even lock their doors.
I do love...
Maybe it's a suburb where no one has locks on their doors.
I do love that scene when he first enters the town, and the first house that he sees, the window is open, and the blinds are open, and there's a giant jewelry box with, like, tons of jewels sitting on the windowsill.
Yeah. That's our new theory, or at least it's mine. I don't know. How do you feel about my theory that this is a suburb where no one even has locks?
I think it's a good theory because this movie's ridiculous. So
Yeah.
You have Dennis here who is terrorizing everyone, mostly Mr. Wilson for some reason. And then...
Because he's and there. Then, he's nearby.
And then you have this thing where Christopher Lloyd comes in as the character Switchblade Sam. He's like a drifter, and his plan, I guess, is to, I don't know, steal everything from the town.
Well, there's no locks on the door, and everyone just leaves their jewelry in the window, so...
But he does a lot of, like, weird stuff in this that doesn't make a lot of sense.
No.
And then there's this whole other subplot involving this orchid that Mr. Wilson has where, like, it only blooms, like, once every 40 years or something.
That was strangely the most interesting part of the movie for me. I don't know what that means. I was really following that subplot.
And so at one point, the Christopher Lloyd's character kidnaps Dennis, but Dennis doesn't realize it, and then he terrorizes Christopher mm-hmm. Lloyd in a really, like, kind of series of very violent things that happened to him, where he's, like, getting burned and stabbed and, like, all of this other horrible stuff is happening to him. You know, you have some fart mm-hmm. jokes in here, too, which is... I love the scene when the handcuff key falls into the beans, and rather than just pull the handcuff key out, he decides to eat all of the beans to get to retrieve the key. But then he eats the key. Like, it's just, there's so many ridiculous things in this. But he does get stabbed in the butthole at one point, so that should give you a clue as to how what's going on in this movie. It's like I said before, it's exactly what you would expect from a 90s kids movie where they have absolutely no respect for parents in this. It's definitely got the whole kids rule, parents suck, like that whole vibe to it. I just don't think you would see movies like this popping up today. There was the famous chiclet scene when he's like mm-hmm. playing around with Mr. Wilson's dentures, and then he breaks two of the two front teeth out, and they fall down the sink, and he replaces them with chiclets, and somehow he puts the teeth in and doesn't realize that they've been replaced with chiclets, even though a person would immediately recognize that. They would see it before they mm-hmm. put the teeth in. I like that Natasha Lyonne's in here for a minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you're mentioning just like the cast of this movie, and I'm thinking about how I think I said this about another movie not terribly long ago, but I can't remember what it was, where it's a movie where everything in this movie works except for all the things that are supposed to be funny.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think obviously we're not the right age bracket for this movie, and I think that maybe kids would still find it to be really, really funny. But also, I don't know if like kids should really be seeing movies like this, and because like Dennis just has no respect for authority at all, and. He doesn't learn.
He's a very frightening character.
He doesn't learn anything. Like, he's a stupid little kid. And he doesn't... and he learns no lessons. Mr. Wilson is the one who learns the lesson. And the thing is, like, at the beginning, Mr. Wilson isn't like... Like, I think that his actions or reactions are reasonable. And, yeah, he gets fed up at the end. Towards the end, after Dennis ruins the whole orchid thing, and I
felt really bad for the orchid.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And he tells Dennis off and whatever. So, but the fact that like Mr. Wilson is the one who learns the lesson is, I think, pretty backwards.
Well, the title of the film is Dennis the Menace, and if he stops being a menace, then He can't call him that anymore.
That is true. That is true.
Although I do read here that it was released in the United Kingdom as Dennis, because of the wonderful trivia fact that not only the same year as the American Dennis the Menace comic strip debuted, the exact same day of the year, there was a completely unrelated British comic called Dennis the Menace, which they just started on the exact same day.
That's funny.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. You know, I like Walter Matthau. I think that he was a really funny comedic actor, but. Mm-hmm. The thing about this movie is that it's just not worth it to come for Matthau, because there's so much other stuff in here that is painfully unfunny.
Mm-hmm. His wife's played by Joan Plowright.
Yeah, who's great. Like she's perfect for that role.
Yeah,
and I think Matthau's Mr. Wilson is that's a great role too.
Yeah.
Also, I didn't know this, that the kid who plays Dennis the Menace, the same kid from Rushmore, who was Jason Schwartzman's best friend in Rushmore. Didn't know that. Fun fact.
Yeah. It's an interesting I think about the cast, I think about everything, I think about the everything about this is fine or good, even like you said, Matthau is good here, as one could be considering what this character is supposed to represent, I suppose. I also want to point out, this is on a technical level, just a very well-made movie.
Yeah, it is.
It's just so fascinating when everything except the main part of a movie can be good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then make the movie bad. This is not this is my very deep observation on 1993's Dennis the Menace, but yeah, that's what I would have to offer.
There you go.
It's just shot in that, like, in this, you know, idyllic tree-lined suburb. There is a certain 90s way to shooting that kind of environment.
Oh yeah,
that really comes through here.
90s suburbia.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know. I can't really recommend. It's on HBO Max if you want to watch it, but I don't know. Maybe if you have fond memories of it from when you were a kid, watching it as a kid,
then I'd say don't rewatch it.
Yeah,
keep those memories.
Yeah, because like, I mean, I didn't love the movie or anything. I just remember liking it, so it's not like my memories have been crushed or anything. Mm-hmm.
But you know, sometimes memories are better as memories.
So, as if Dennis the Menace. If Dennis the Menace was bad, then our final movie is just an absolute garbage pile. Like, this movie makes Dennis the Menace look like an Academy Award winner, in my opinion. We're talking about The Phantom from 1996.
On June 7th, stop the evil, beware. Evil, be warned.
I killed him. Years ago.
Evil, be ready.
Well, guess what? He's back.
There are those who say he is only a myth. Soon they will discover the Phantom is real. Rated PG. At theaters everywhere. June 7th.
This is directed by Simon Winsor. I have a synopsis here. The Phantom, descendant of a line of African superheroes, remember that, travels to New York City to thwart a wealthy criminal genius from obtaining three magic skulls, which would give him the secret to ultimate power. So Billy Zane plays the Phantom in this. Now, this is the first time I've ever seen this movie. When this came out, I remember it being completely, like, it just bombed, like, big time bombed. And I never really had an interest in seeing it. So this was actually the first time I've seen this movie. Slam Evil is the tagline here.
That doesn't even make sense.
No, Slam Evil doesn't make sense at all. Also, the three magic skulls thing, like, here's a little spoiler. When you put them together, it's just a laser. Like the ultimate power is just like a laser. So I don't really, I'm not sure how that's ultimate power. Like, it doesn't do anything else other than shoot a laser.
Just a guy with, just some guy running around with a laser pointer.
And the other thing is, like, they find out there's a fourth skull, and guess what? It's the Phantom's skull ring. And when Treat Williams, who's the villain, when he shoots the three skulls, Billy Zane catches him with his skull, and it vaporizes Treat Williams. He just gets vaporized. This movie is incredibly bad. I laughed a lot, although it was very unintentional. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of unintentional comedy in this, and I can't believe that they looked at this and thought that this was going to work. Like, even on paper, I don't think that this would have worked. It's just so bad.
So, I didn't hate this movie as much as you did, but because that might be because I was even less engaged with it. Like, I couldn't, it just did not hold my attention at all. And so I just kind of completely checked out. I was just gazing almost through the screen instead of at it. And because it was just not, there was just nothing happening to grab me my attention. It took me like 2 days to watch this. and then when I was just thinking, you know what? Some of the production design's good. And I don't know, I give it like a 2.5 or a 3 on Letterboxd.
I mean,
because it's like,
I do agree that the production design is good. I didn't even know that this movie took place in the 30s. So that was kind of a fun surprise for me.
Yeah, it's taking place right alongside Dick Tracy.
Yep. So, yeah, I mean, that I think was cool. I agree that some of the production design looks good. I like some of the tropical locales and the scenes in New York. I think that all of that looked pretty good. The Phantom costume, I'm a little torn on, because I think that it actually looks kind of cool because you have these subtle skulls on the costume itself, but the fact that it's bright purple, and I know that harkens back to the source material, but it just does, it looks ridiculous. I'm sorry. Like, Billy Zane as this guy in this bright purple skin tight suit, and the thing, and like the action scenes aren't even good. So the fight scenes look ridiculous because not only is it Billy Zane wearing a bright purple suit, but like the fight choreography is like not very well done either. So it's I think that it's kind of a failure on many levels. Treat Williams as Xander Drax is a ridiculous villain whose motivations are so surface level, where he's just like, oh, I heard these skulls like give you power, so I kind of want that power, so I'm gonna go for it.
I mean, there's almost something to admire about him, about a story that's willing to just be that completely, just make that such a throwaway.
Yeah. You have Catherine Zeta-Jones in here in a relatively early role for her, and she's kind of an interesting character because she's bad, but then she just flip-flops and switches over to the good guys at one point. James Remar plays like he's like the number one henchman, Quill. And he's a good character in this. I like his character. He adds a little bit of dimension, at least, to what is otherwise a pretty generic henchman character.
I think I just ended up liking this movie, well, not liking it, tolerating this movie just because it let me, it let itself be idle in front of me. It's like, I like, this looks nice. I'm not even, you could, this movie could just say whatever it wanted in terms of this plot, and I don't think I'd even process it at this point. I was also just really tired and stressed out and the day I started watching this, so the fact that it required very little of me might have helped. So this might have been circumstantial as well, but like, yeah. I notice here on this film's largely unsourced Wikipedia page that Joel Schumacher was apparently considered to direct.
Oh man, that would have been...
Now that...
Here's the thing. If you told me Joel Schumacher directed this, I would just believe it. I'd be like, oh yeah, that tracks. That definitely tracks. There probably would have been more purple lighting, but...
It could have used it. I would have made it even better, honestly.
There's a really great scene when Treat Williams is, he's like confronting this guy, and this guy doesn't want to like work with him or whatever, and he kills the guy. But the way that he does it is he has a microscope in his office, and he tells the guy to look in it, and the guy's like, I don't see anything. And he's like, oh, just focus it. And when you turn the focus knob, blades come out of the two eyepieces in the microscope. And first of all, I'm like, oh, that's a clever way to kill somebody. But then I'm thinking, like, what scenario did he, like, either did he, like, have that commission to be made for him? Or did he buy it like that? And then I'm thinking, like, did he foresee a scenario in which he thought, oh, I might need to kill somebody in this office. Let me come up with a device that can do that. Oh, yeah, a microscope that ejects blades out of the eyepieces.
You never know.
There's just so much going on with this one scenario here. And also, like, would it even work? Like, because it works as a microscope, too. The guy looks in it, and when he focuses it, Treat Williams already had a piece of paper in there that said liar, and then the blades came out. So, like, logistically, how would it work if there were blades in the eyepieces? How would he still be able to see the paper there that says liar? There's just so many questions surrounding this microscope. I need answers. I need answers. Yeah. With the blade microscope, because I like it, but there's just too many questions that I have surrounding it.
I'm learning so much about this movie in real time from you. I don't even know if what I'm saying on my end counts as a review, because I just sat down and I was just kind of melting out of my seat. Like, it took me, like, it was like a while in before I looked at it and went, oh, so he's the Phantom.
You just let the Phantom wash over you.
Yeah, it was not a good day.
He does have an alter ego. He has like a secret identity in this, which is his name's Kit something, if I remember correctly. And he acts like the love interest wouldn't know that it's him, even though it's like incredibly obvious. But yeah, I don't know. This movie, it's just stupid. It's just a stupid, dumb movie. I'd say if you're looking, because I think that this came out around the time The Shadow came out, which I actually liked The Shadow a lot. We couldn't really cover it on this episode because The Shadow is based on a radio show, I believe. No, The Shadow came out in 94, from the looks of it. So a year later. I thought they came out around the same time. Either way, I think The Shadow is much better than this. And or another one that we couldn't cover, The Rocketeer. Like, that's based on a comic book, And I think that that one is leaps and bounds above something like this.
Yeah, I can't say much for this movie in both the literal and metaphorical senses. You're helping me piece all this together. I watched it, but I don't know what I could really say. I just think this is a nice looking movie. You're making me realize all these things I didn't realize, like the weird whitewashing to it and the microscopes and the fact that I was thinking, was it just that I was not in a great headspace when I started watching this movie that I didn't understand why these characters are doing anything? But apparently that's just how it is.
there's really no rhyme or reason. Also, like, when he punches you, apparently you immediately get a scar that's in the shape of a skull on your face.
Yeah.
Which is really unfortunate for anybody that he punches. This is when he's slamming evil, I guess.
Yeah.
This had a $45 million budget, and it grossed $17.3 million, so it was an utter failure.
People were not going to see The Phantom.
They weren't buying the Billy Zane superhero thing.
This was not the summer smash hit of 1996.
Also, they really, really go out of their way to avoid the Phantom just straight up murdering people, because the whole thing with the Phantom is that he has these dual 1911 pistols, and you do see him shooting, but he's always like shooting swords out of people's hands, which like completely incapacitates them. By the way, you shoot a sword out of somebody's hand, they're done. Like, they're not picking it back up. They're not continuing the fight. They're just going home. They're like, all right, I'm done. Like that. I can't. This is it for me. So there's a lot of scenes like that where there's like people with swords and guns and stuff, but they're not like explicitly killing each other or anything. So I think they're trying to keep it. What is PG, actually? I just noticed that.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
they're trying to keep it family friendly here. I did notice also there were some kind of weird ADR moments where I think that maybe there was some swearing that got ADR'd out to keep it on that PG rating. So yeah, I don't know.
They wanted to make sure that everyone would be able to go see The Phantom and slam evil. Unfortunately, nobody did.
I also thought it was interesting how at the end when he takes his mask off, first of all, the eyepiece is attached to like the cowl, like the head neck piece. So it's all like one piece. But as you watch the movie, you realize that he has black eye makeup on to like blacken his eyes and stuff. But then in that scene at the end when he takes it off, he doesn't have eye makeup on. So somehow taking off the mask like removed all of his eye makeup, which I thought was kind of interesting. So I don't know.
Maybe they were going to go into that in the Phantom 2.
The Phantom 2 Electric Boogaloo.
Yes. But nobody saw the Phantom. Well, $17 million, or however, how much did it make again?
Yeah, like
$17 million worth of ticket sales to people going to see The Phantom, which was not enough to give us The Phantom 2.
Yep. Anything else you want to add about The Phantom?
Not really. I don't even know if I get to say that I really reviewed it.
It's a nothing burger of a movie. Like,
yeah, I'm coming around and feeling better about the longer we go on, because for a while I was thinking, God, I must have been more out of it than I thought when I started watching it. Because the second day I was going back and I was thinking with a slightly better headspace and thinking, nothing in this movie makes sense. Nothing. I feel like I'm missing a bunch. And I was like going back and trying to watch other scenes, and it was like, I don't know what's going on here. So I just at one point I was like, well, this is making it worse, so I'll just keep watching. And then I finally got to this podcast, and now I'm beginning to realize, oh no, that's just how this movie is.
Oh yeah, like none of it really makes any sense. Like they try, there's these like exposition dumps where they try to explain like all of it, and there's a scene in the very beginning of the movie that shows like the original Phantom and like how the original Phantom was created or whatever, and it's none of it really makes any sense or has any reason of being. Like there's just no reason for this to exist.
So that's my review of The Phantom. You can start watching this movie as I did in the fried headspace of just having a really stressful day and like just coming out of anxiety spiral, and you'll watch it and you'll think, I was not in the right headspace to watch this, and then you'll realize eventually, oh no, that's just how it is. I don't actually think I missed that much.
I've been there.
Reflecting on it.
I've been there with so many movies where you watch it out of obligation, and then you think that you're like, oh well, I clearly wasn't in the right headspace for that, and then you realize that it was just, no, that's just how the movie was.
Yeah, it's just how I was so ready a couple minutes ago to say, I don't know if I could technically say I reviewed this, and then I thought back, and then it just all clicked in my head. Everything I saw, everything we had talked about, and it's like, I might have gotten closer to this understanding what there is to understand this movie than I thought.
Yeah. All right, well, I think that's going to wrap it up for this month. Thank you so much for listening. You can send us your 90s topics to 90s@filmpulse.net, or you can send us a DM on Twitter or Facebook at 90spod. Until next month, for Ken Bakley, my name's Adam Patterson, and this has been Saved by the 90s.
Bye, everyone.